And now, in conversation with the boyhood heroes who became his broadcasting colleagues, this is My Radio 1 with Sean
Tilley. From its launch in 1967, right through the 70s to the mid-80s, BBC Radio 1 was probably the world's biggest music station. In this series, I'm introducing you to many of the people behind the network's success during those golden years, as they each tell the story of their Radio 1. Sean
Tilley. My Radio 1.
And it is always an undiluted thrill to shoot the breeze with this man.
Paul Gambaccini. Hello, Sean. Good to be here.
It is very, very nice to see you, Paul. I really appreciate you coming in here and sharing your Radio 1. But it was the work that you were doing for Rolling Stone magazine as a British correspondent that initially got you through the door, wasn't it?
Well, it certainly was. It was the spring of 1970, and I was crossing the college green at my American university, which was called Dartmouth College, because there was a Dartmouth College case before the Supreme Court decades before. So they kept the name college, even though it was a university. And I ran into a friend of mine called Bob Harrington, and he said, "Have you applied to Oxford yet?" And I said, "No, why?" And he said, "It's a 2-year paid vacation." And during that last term at Dartmouth, the student body had gone on strike because there was a national student strike over Nixon's invasion of Cambodia. And one night I was awakened at about 12:15 by the program director of the college radio station, and he asked me if I could fill in on the breakfast show. And I said, "Well, yeah, okay, fine." But in those days, if I was awakened shortly after falling asleep, I couldn't get back to sleep for another hour. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? I finished my thesis, my courses are canceled, and my friends are asleep. And I thought, you always thought you could write a better singles review than Ed Ward. Ed Ward was the singles review editor of Rolling Stone. And I could tell from some of his pieces that his heart really wasn't in that assignment, because some of his other pieces were happier. And so I wrote a review of what was my then favorite single, Band of Gold, by Freda Payne. And then I went to sleep, got up, did the breakfast show, went to class, got back, thought, I can't just send off one. I've got to write another one. So I wrote a pan of 3 then current British pop singles, My Baby Loves Lovin', United We Stand, and That Same Old Feeling. Yeah. A week later, which shows you that the post moved faster in those days, I got a letter back from Ed Ward saying, anything that makes me laugh as much as your White Plains, etc. review has to go in. So, enclosed, please find your Rolling Stone due date calendar, which was one of those pocket Elvis jobs with days circled. Yeah, yeah. So, I started reviewing records for Rolling Stone via the post, because, of course, in those days, it was not only pre-internet, it was pre-fax. And I started appearing regularly in Rolling Stone. So, when I came over to England, and I could really tell you several stories about coming into London for Rolling Stone, but that's another interview. And I kept running into John Peel and his producer, John Walters, because in those days, pre-internet, to see an artist, you had to actually physically see them. You couldn't look at them on the internet. You had to be there to be there. And so we met each other at many showcases, and we got on great. We had similar tastes. Then, to quickly fast forward, I did a front cover story for Rolling Stone on Elton John. Elton's publicist was Helen Walters, who was John Walters' wife. And she took me out to lunch to thank me and brought along John Walters, who asked me over the course of the lunch, "I'm starting a rock magazine in the program. I'd love to have a 10-minute American looks at the scene. Would you like to do it?" Would I like to do it? I thought, would I like to fly to the moon under my own power? I had been working on the radio station at college about 10 hours a day, and I had been denied an audition at Radio Oxford. It was like being unemployed at the age of 21. Mm. And so the opportunity to be on another radio station was thrilling. So I went to do this pilot talk. Chris Lycett was the engineer, and Tony Wilson was the producer. And I read my piece, and I was expecting to be ripped to shreds. And Tony said, fine. And it was broadcast. And that was the beginning. So I was a regular on this program, which was called Rock Speak. And for the first year, it was hosted by Michael Whale. And the second year, the title changed to Rock Week. And John Peel was the host. And I worked, as Andy Kershaw would later work, out of John Walters' office. So I shared the office with John Peel, which, of course, was one of the best things a person could do unintentionally in his career, because you just soak up all of that brilliance.
This is Paul Gambaccini. And the reason John Peel is not here is kind of unique, and I'm very excited to be able to do the program tonight, because this must be a first for this particular kind of excuse for being absent. John is all wet, and so are some of his records, because he lives on low-lying ground, and some water during today's thaw has seeped into the ground and has got some of his records wet, because he keeps his record collection down in the lowest part of the house. So he's desperately moving the records to another room. I'm not going to spend any time apologizing for not being John Peel. I already spent enough time apologizing for who I am. So why don't I start it off with the record that Peel would have started it off with?
I was still at Oxford. So I was coming in on the train. I knew the train schedules by heart. This is how pathetic it is. And I still remember the shock when the round-trip fare from Oxford to London went up from £1.35 to £1.85. And so I came in to London early the evening of my first live Peel Dep, as they say in the business. And I was taken out to dinner by Richard Branson, who was the then head of the struggling record store Virgin, but who had started a label. And he just flashed out on this fancy dinner at Pizza Hut in Notting Hill Gate. And he said to me, in 2 hours, you will be speaking to the nation. Where do you find the courage? Well, of course, in a couple of years later, he would be floating over the Atlantic in a hot air balloon. Where did he find the courage? And so Richard Branson's the person who taught me that courage is a relative concept. What terrifies some people doesn't faze somebody else at all, and vice versa. And I did do that first show. And
18th of April, 1974.
Oh, my gosh.
That's when it was.
Well done. And my sessions were Joan Armatrading and Buddy Knox, because Peel said, choose one new session and one old session. And I chose Buddy Knox because Party Doll, which was an American number one for him, was one of the two first 7-inch physical singles I had seen as a little boy.
Rare indeed is the voice so unique it can be recognized after only a few notes. Ray Charles has such a voice. When you hear his soulful, mournful cry, you know it has to be the genius.
During your time with Radio 1, you gained a formidable reputation as the king of documentaries, profiling the life stories of the biggest names in the music business. And this began as early as November 1974, when you began your All-American Heroes. It was not only a celebrated series, but I would think an awful lot of work as well.
Once you've done the first one, no matter how much time you took doing the first one, you have a week to do the second one.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's, And so I would get into the rotation of doing the broadcast. Although All American Heroes, they were taped. They were live in the 80s. And then the next day you start, you give yourself all your research time. I mean, you've accumulated your research materials. No internet, remember? And then you do the writing. And fortunately, I had a producer with whom I was totally sympathetic. And then I briefly went to Boston for half a year to be executive producer of WBZ, which was one of the 7 largest radio stations in America, 50,000-watt clear channel. The whole thing was driving me mad. And one day I got a phone call from Stuart Grundy, my producer on All American Heroes, saying, we finally got approval for your American hit show. It's going to start in September. And I said, what American hit show? Because they'd planned it without even telling me. This often happens in broadcasting. You gain and lose shows without being told. And I said, well, obviously I've got to go back because I just hate this job. And so I went back, and voila, here I am.
Hey, maybe someday I'll take things over.
5 p.m. Saturday, the 27th of September, 1975.
The one thing I regret about that show is that John Denver was number one with I'm Sorry. And he knocked Fame by David Bowie off number one. And, and the following week, Fame by David Bowie came back. But I thought, how am I going to close this show by saying John Denver is number one? I'm sorry. So that's why I put in until.
Next week's Paul Gambaccini show plays next week's American hits. John Denver is number one
with I'm Sorry.
It's cold here in the city. It always seems that way.
In those days, all of the Radio 1 DJs had what we call the pigeonholes, which was your mail slots. And the producers would come around and put the latest records in your pigeonhole. It was the only way to get you a record quickly. It was quicker than the post, even. Although you got a lot of things at home as well. But for the American hits, I would go down to the office of Billboard magazine, because they had a London office that they were tied in with Music Week. I'd get an advanced copy of the magazine. And I would see the charts. Again, this is pre-internet. And so I'd go through them, and I'd say to my producer, Mike Hawks, these are the ones I'd like to play. And so we'd call up the record, the promotion people who would be representing those records when they were released in Britain. And usually the record companies got two or three advanced copies of each American single. And I would get one of them by request. Very privileged position, I know. Also, it shows you what a fly-by-your-pants procedure this was. We relied on these promotion people to give us one of their three copies or one of their two copies. And then at the beginning, Mike wanted to make one change of program, and then in the end, he just let me do it all. God bless him.
Walter Murphy and the Big Apple Band went to number one in the States in October with a fifth of Beethoven. For the year 1976, they come in at number 10. Here's the artist who sold the most in the States this year and meant the least over here, Gary Wright. His album Dreamweaver came in number 6 for the year. The title track was the number 37 single of the year. And this track, Love is Alive, is the number 9 single of the year without doing hardly anything in Britain. Gary Wright, Love is Alive at number 9.
Now you see, Love is Alive, Gary Wright, and also Dreamweaver, two great examples. Alongside the likes of Moonlight Feels Right by Starbuck, Welcome Back, John Sebastian, and a year or so later, Alan O'Day, Undercover Angel. Of songs that you played on your program first, and then other Radio 1 DJ started playing them, you were not only an influence, it seems, on your colleagues, but the Radio 1 playlist as a whole.
This was a completely unintentional byproduct, as far as I was concerned, but I became aware that some of the members of the playlist committee, because it was a committee, would listen to my show to see how the records transmit. That was the verb that was used. How does this record transmit? And so we got Convoy away, for example. And Disco Duck.
Yes.
I mean, things that might never have been added because they were just so off-piste. Mm. But because the playlist committee thought, these transmit well. So they were added to the Radio 1 playlist, which was great. And then also, I was very pleased that some of the R&B stuff that I played was picked up on by R&B fans. Like, I was the first person to play One Nation Under a Groove.
Yeah.
Which was a record that came to mean a lot for a lot of people.
Such was the popularity of Radio 1 DJs in the 1970s and the 1980s particularly. There was that sort of showbiz side of it. And at this time, you were assuming the role. You were getting out there and doing disco appearances. And I remember for a time on air as well, you were referring to yourself as the station's most eligible bachelor.
Most eligible bachelor.
Radio 1's most eligible bachelor. Counting down America's top hits of 1976 and the four seasons at number 4, December 1963.
I had no idea when I joined Radio 1, at the invitation of John Walters, remember, I didn't apply, how big it was. I would have said that as a kind of send-up of of the press that my other DJ friends were getting. But I, of course, wasn't interested in personal publicity because I was interested in this musical knowledge, which some people call trivia. I consider it the milk of human kindness or whatever you want to call it. And so I had already started compiling the Guinness Book of British Hit Singles with the Rice Brothers and their friend Mike Reed, never dreaming that Mike Reed would wind up on Radio 1. And it took us 4 years to collect all the info for the first edition of that book. And my main job, we divided up the labor. I wrote the prose, but my main job was to go to the BBC library and check the label of every record that had ever made the chart so that we had the exact correct billing. To use an example which everyone can relate to, Bill Haley and his Comets. It's not Bill Haley and the Comets. It's Bill Haley and his Comets. And then which orchestras were credited with which vocalists in the early days when they did that. So we had to do that. As a matter of fact, we were very near finishing, but there were two points we couldn't figure out. The nationality of two artists, because we had decided we would have the nationality of each artist who'd ever made the chart. Hal Page and the Wailers, that's W-H-A-L-E-R, and Bob Azam. And then one day Tim said, "Great news. I found out that Hal Page and the Wailers are American. They're from the Pacific Northwest." So that settled that one. So Mike Hawks, my producer, and also the producer of Kid Jensen, said, "How's the book going?" And I said, "Well, it's nearly finished, but there's the nationality of one artist that we just can't find." And he said, "Who is it?" And I said, "It's Bob Azam." And he said, "Oh, he's Egyptian." And I said, "How do you know?" And he said, "I have the EP, and it says he's from Cairo." You can't imagine the joy spread through the Western world that night. Bob Azam was Egyptian. So that was the part of things that really was the strongest bit of me, was Mr. Knowledge, as somebody crazily called me on the internet once. But it wasn't personality profiles in the papers, so I never went for that.
But it went with the territory, of course, and I cannot tell you the impact that first book made in terms of being, you know, a chart show fanatic like I was. Finally, there was a publication that could tell you, you know, what position a record got in the chart. I mean, it absolutely blew up, didn't it? People went nuts for it.
This is a real study of unintended consequences. We didn't think anything was going to happen with this book, but Doreen Davies, executive producer, decided it would make a great giveaway, a prize, to listeners, particularly on the Paul Burnett show at lunchtime.
So, with the Tuesday chart reveal.
That's right. And so the book was mentioned almost every day for a year on Radio 1. One night, I go to Piccadilly Circus late Saturday night to pick up the Sunday papers, because the first editions of the Sunday papers usually came out around midnight in London. And I looked at the book review section, and in the top 10 were number 6. And nobody told me. We were number 6 in the bestsellers, and it was like an April Fool's joke. I was looking for the cameras. And the next week, we were number 4. And what had happened was all these mentions, this was 11 months after publication, had created this word of mouth. People like yourself. It was absolutely extraordinary. So when we were number 4, Guinness said, "Can we please have a second edition?" and that's when it got serious. But it took all that time. And I've always credited Doreen with helping the book become a success.
In 1967, he spotted an ad in the New Musical Express. Liberty Records needed new talent. Reg could write melodies and replied. Bernie Taupin could write lyrics. He also replied. They began working together, and Reg recorded under the new name Elton John. The string of hits they enjoyed made their partnership seem a marriage made in heaven. But why did it work?
I don't know. All my life when I grew up, I always wanted a brother. I always had a real close friend. I don't suppose I ever had one. And Bernie and I sort of, when we started writing together, became very, very close. In fact, he was entirely different to me. He was the one who idolized Lincolnshire. He was the English country-loving person and kept ramming England down my throat.
You'd had the Elton John story, which, of course, was a six-parter. That's another much celebrated series that you're remembered very fondly for. Of course, this name Elton John's going to keep on coming up. Elton even stood in for you for a couple of weeks on your American Sharp program as well.
This was the first appearance of Elton, as far as I know.
EJ the DJ, as
correct.
He became, yeah.
Correct. He became EJ the DJ. The ironic thing is, of course, since I was out of the country, I didn't hear it. No internet.
He was also present at another historic broadcast in your Radio 1 career. For many, many years, you'd been reviewing the singles on a regular basis with Roscoe initially and then Kid Jensen on Roundtable. Friday 30th of May 1980, however, you take over the reins of the programme. And not only Elton's there, but somebody who, when you look at true worldwide music stars who made a phenomenal impact, particularly in the case of this man, the 1960s, when you'd have been growing up, of course, being music mad, and then again in the 1970s. Well, I mean, you tell everybody who I'm talking about.
Frankie Valli. And this was a very emotional occasion because Kid was going to go to America.
My name is Paul Gambaccini, and if you've been following the radio times, you know that I was scheduled to do this program in place of the holiday in Kid Jensen. But if you've been following the newspapers, you know that things have changed a bit. And it's not a holiday. It's a new career for Kid in the United States. And so I thought that for the first hour of today's program, we'll turn it back to the Kid and let him do what he would like in his last program on Radio 1. Hi, Kid.
Paul, thank you very much for that. And it's my last show. God, what a day I've had. It's been a really emotional day. I didn't realize I had so many friends around here, and it'll be the last time that Kid Jensen takes to the airwaves as well.
That's right, because you will revert to your real name after this.
That's right. What is it again? I've forgotten.
It's David Allen
Horatio.
Yes, that's right. Cod Jensen.
Algernon. David Allen Jensen reigns from next week, but for now it's Kid Jensen with the Four Seasons. Who loves you? I feel love.
And I still have the running order signed by everybody because it was such an emotional occasion.
We got a lovely clip of you on Roundtable. This one is from the 29th of August 1980. It's you in the studio with Radio 1 colleague Paul Burnett and Kate Bush.
Gambaccini, Radio 1 Roundtable.
Thank you, Stephen the Cape, and also congratulations to Richard the Skinner for a wonderful spell of programs in the late afternoon on Radio 1.
Yeah.
That's right, and that's Paul Burnett saying here, by the way.
Yes.
I mean, you'll still be here next week, so you can afford to say that.
I hope so, yes. New time, 12:45 to 2:35.
And joining us at the round table, my name, by the way, is still Paul the Gambaccini. It's the winner of the British Rock and Pop Award as the Best Female Singer of the Year. Welcome, Kate Bush.
Thank you.
And this is a return to the round table for you.
Yes, it is, and the first time at a real round table.
That's right. Last time you were upstairs, folks, the architectural story here, and now downstairs in the basement at the actual original round table.
Well, you got me because I didn't know that any bit of round table that I'd ever been on still survived. And of course, I adored Kate Bush, but we got on. That's the important thing.
Very soon after this, you'd be doing a two-part series with her as well.
Which was hilarious because Radio 1 thought, oh, wow, this is great. Holiday special, Kate Bush, all these hits. And of course, she was playing the music she loved and inspired her, which included things like sea shanties and folk songs. And they weren't pop records at all. Kate had learned a lot of music from her older brother, who was into this more esoteric material. And of course, as we know from the career of Kate Bush, she never tried to make records like other people. She was her own artist.
Kate Bush. Hello, Kate.
Hi.
Now, we've invited you to pick your favorite records, and we didn't know when we did so what kind of record you would like, if it would be a selection of top 40 hits, or if you liked some classical music, or perhaps female singing in high voices. We had no idea whatsoever. And you've come up with a list which is as varied as any selection I've ever seen on Radio 1. And it reminds me of some of the free-form radio stations that used to exist in the United States. So we're going to have an exciting time.
That's interesting. Yeah, I bet you didn't know what you were letting yourselves in for.
We'll give an example straight away. This one is from Alan Stavell, and it's called The Kimmyad. Now, this is one I have not heard before.
So this meant that there would be two one-hour specials. They were unlike any one-hour specials ever. it actually would be a blast to play them now, because people would just think, good Lord, that is the quintessence of Kate Bush. She's unique.
And now the end is near. The end of the series, that is. And as I face the final pips, I wonder who I should choose as the subject of my last tribute. This is the 39th program, and yet there are still many artists whose music has meant a great deal to me whom I haven't saluted. People like Van Morrison, the Belfast boy whose music conveys both sensitivity and passion. The witty and perceptive Kinks, and the Manhattan marvel, Lou Reed. I haven't even tried to deal with acts who have recently emerged and may still be in the ascendancy, writer-performers such as Elvis Costello, Joe Jackson, and The Police. Some other year, or some other lifetime. If this series is to go out with anything resembling a bang, I must pick the man who has made the biggest musical noise in the last quarter century. A man behind the largest-selling single in British history, and the one it replaced. A man with 8 American number ones since the breakup of the Beatles. A patriotic chap who would be proud to be told he is the world's most famous living Englishman. We don't need an envelope to reveal the identity of the amazing Paul McCartney.
All American heroes we talked about earlier on. And it was a forerunner to the 1981. I say 1981. It continued for quite a few years after that appreciation of series. And that surely has to be one of the standout highlights of your time at Radio 1.
Well, it does. It actually was turned into 2 paperback books.
And you did these programs live. Let me take you back to when you said this earlier on. You did these live? I can't believe that.
We did them live. And so we'd be... I know it sounds impossible, because they included talk-ups and fade-outs, and lots of fade-outs. And Teddy Warwick was there with a stopwatch. And we just did them. And it was like the pentathlon for presenters, really, because it was all your skills required in the same program.
And I can now reveal to you, exclusively on the wireless waves of Radio 1 across the nation, we made it. Last night, as the sun dipped in the west, we dipped into Oxford. And
the name of Mike Reed comes up again, because he, alongside Noel Edmonds and you, set off from Hampton Court on a river trip to Oxford as Radio 1 recreated Jerome K. Jerome's 3-minute boat. And this was not without incident, I think it's fair to say.
Well, the whole trip was full of incident. And there were things that happened interpersonally that were very revealing. But the one episode which, of course, really struck me was that I did not kill a woman who I easily could have inadvertently killed, because there was a fan of Noel, because this was when Noel was the top teen scream. And one of Noel's fans jumped into the river hoping to meet him. I mean, okay, this is really weird. And she obviously did not realize that steering a boat is pretty hard, and it's harder to keep it in idle so that it's not moving. But I was able to not move the boat. And Dave Tate, who was the producer, jumped in and got the girl out of the water.
Well, I must honestly say that this week the standard of rivermanship has been exceedingly high.
I think it's been absolutely marvelous.
1986, Paul. You decided to leave Radio 1, and it was to go to Capital. I mean, it wasn't that straightforward a move, because obviously there was a commercial radio network show involved. You were doing an album chart, I think, as well as the American Countdown, weren't you? Which you took to what they called in those days independent local radio. But there were quite a number of stations now up and down the country at this point.
This was an attempt by commercial radio to have a definitive chart show of its own. Because, of course, the BBC had locked up the singles chart with the Top 40 show. And so I was asked if I would do a national album show. I said, well, I'll do it, but I have to still do the American hits.
Until we meet again, and I know we will. Thank you.
Johnny Beeling, the controller, had told me when I left Radio 1 to do this album show for the commercial sector, he'd said, go away for a few years, make a lot of money, and then come back. And I said, all right, let's see if he meant it. And he did. And so we went back to Radio 1 doing doc series and things like that.
Yeah. Paul, thank you so much for sharing what has been an incredible Radio 1 story.
You're very welcome.